This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, we remember Afghanistan's most influential female police officer.
Well, of course she got killed. It's almost like her very existence was a finger in the Taliban's eye.
Plus, power sharing and power cuts, the hopes and challenges facing Zimbabwe, and reading, writing, and reconciliation. That's the lesson plan at the Hope Flowers School in the West Bank.
The idea of this school is to find a new Palestinian generation who believes in democracy and peace and to teach the children in the sense of peace rather than in the sense of war.
All that's ahead. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The situation in Afghanistan is getting worse. The top U.S. military commander in the country has asked for more troops to fight the resurging Taliban. The request comes just days after Taliban gunmen shot and killed Afghanistan's top female police officer. Captain Mullalai Kakar was the head of Kandahar's Department of Crimes Against Women. She was known throughout Afghanistan for her bravery and had survived several assassination attempts before. Sarah Chase went to Afghanistan in 2001 to report on the fall of the Taliban for National Public Radio. She ended up staying there and starting a cooperative that makes skincare products. She was friends with Mullalai Kakar, the assassinated police officer. Sarah Chase joins us now on her cell phone from Afghanistan. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, can you tell us what the local reaction has been to the murder of Mullalai Kakar?
Aghast, really. I work with men and women in my cooperative, and the women, I mean, they were pretty speechless. Mullalai was basically the one female in a position of authority. I mean, there are other women in the provincial assembly and things like that, but they don't exercise any authority, and Mullalai was always there for women. People were really blown away.
I imagine. Now, she'd been getting death threats for some time before she was actually shot. And this is a woman who was the mother of six children, some of them young. Why was she so driven to continue her work instead of removing herself from obvious danger?
You know, I think she was just dedicated to it. She was a police officer. Her father was a police officer. And I think that she really felt that this was how she could contribute to people. And, you know, the significance of leaving a job like that, when you've been that dedicated, is just psychologically too great. It really means the giving up of hope for this experiment in, you know, post-Taliban nation building.
What was it that made her such a prime target for the Taliban? Is it just because she was a woman in such a high position of power?
Definitely. This place is a slaughterhouse for police. I mean, you've heard about her because she's such an extraordinary and unusual individual, but we lose 10 or 15 police officers a week down here in the southern Afghanistan. And the reason, there are a couple of reasons for that. They are really the part of government that's closest to the people. And the Taliban are trying to separate the people from government. So what the Taliban don't want to see is a functioning, service-oriented police department.
Right.
So in that regard, Mullalai, just as a police officer who really worked very hard for the people, was exactly the kind of police officer that they're targeting. On top of that, she was a female. So it's almost like her very existence was a finger in the Taliban's eye.
So do you think she knew her days were numbered?
Oh, definitely. But to some extent, we all do. I mean, my heart sank, not just because she was a friend of mine, but symbolically, I felt like, well, of course she got killed. Why wouldn't she get killed, given everybody else who's getting killed? It was inevitable that she get killed. And so I had this image in my mind of, like, a sheep. You know, like a sheep eating grass until the day that it's slaughtered, right? And I started, you know, using that metaphor to the people around me, my cooperative members, myself, frankly, you know, and saying, are we all sheep eating grass and you know, passing our days eating grass until the day we get slaughtered? It's a horrible metaphor to use, but yeah, to some degree, I just was sitting with another of my cooperative members when you called, and he said, I don't see more than 1 hour into the future. I can believe that I'm going to be alive for an hour, but beyond an hour, I don't know what's going to happen to me or what's going to happen to one of my family members. He's a former police officer.
Mm.
And that's really the kind of anxiety that everybody down here is living under.
And you mentioned that people, of course, even in this country, are aghast that this woman who was so heroic has been shot down. And you work with women. I'm just wondering what the women on the street are saying. Do they have any hope? Because they really had made quite a lot of progress in the last couple of years. And now it seems like everything's going backwards.
I would say they made a lot of progress in 2002 and 2003. And after about 2003, it started to slip. Not steadily, but kind of in fits and starts. And basically, I mean, if what I just told you is how a man feels about his future, just imagine what women feel. I hate to sound this kind of apocalyptic, but I really think that the direness of the situation isn't really that well understood, and the degree of people's despair, you know? And I think part of the despair is not just that Malalai got killed, it's that there's absolutely no chance that the people who killed her will get caught. These things happen, they get blamed on the Taliban, and then that's the end of it. And so there's a feeling of chaos and impunity down here that makes it really, really difficult for people to look into the future.
All right. Sarah Chase, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Chase is a former journalist for NPR who now lives and works in Afghanistan. Our next story is also about challenges facing women, this time in Mexico. Many women there are left to survive on their own when their husbands move to the U.S. in search of work. Here's a story about a group of women who've banded together to form their own neighborhood. Conrad Fox reports.
In this cramped little shack, Maria Santos and her five young children are eating lunch. There's just enough room for chairs between the table and the tar paper walls. Clothes, cooking pots and other possessions fill empty spaces. At night, 12-year-old Lalo sleeps on a top bunk that's just inches from the roof.
Sometimes when I'm sleeping, the wind lifts up the roof. I have to grab it to keep it down, but I can't do it for long because I'm sleeping. And the wind blows in.
There's other problems, too. The house floods during heavy rains. There's a noxious-smelling open sewer running a few dozen yards down the hill from here. But Maria says it's just a relief to have somewhere to live.
I love this house because it's cost me sweat and tears. This is the best thing I own. After my children, it's the best thing I have.
Except that she doesn't really own it, or at least not the land it's built on. 2.5 years ago, Maria's husband left for the U.S. to work illegally. With no money for even the cheapest rent, she joined a handful of other single mothers who had begun to build houses here on unused government land. Word of the squatters' colony spread, and it grew to almost 100 families, almost all headed by women. It's just a collection of huts, some of tar paper, others of brick stacked without even cement to hold them together. All of the homes cling to a slope on the edge of town. But for these women, who earn an average of about $40 a week, cleaning houses or selling trinkets on the streets, it beats paying rent. Still, the settlement is technically illegal.
For a while, we lived with fear. The government was going to send the police to kick us off. You see on the news how they knock over houses with everything in them. We live with fear that in any moment you'd come home and imagine lose everything you've worked for, have nothing, end up on the street with nothing.
That fear united the families. Maria's 7-year-old daughter, Joanna, reenacts the slogan that she, her mother, and all the other settlers shouted during protest marches demanding that the local government grant them title to their land.
We were 2 hours shouting, "We want a solution." It was like impotence and excitement at the same time shouting. The next day, my throat was sore. But thanks to God, they respect us now. They don't bother us like they used to.
The settlement is still illegal, but public attention and the assistance of a local politician has led to negotiations with the government for the right to live here. Meanwhile, the women keep working to improve their neighborhood. On a Saturday afternoon, a few dozen of them squat in the ground, hacking at grass with machetes. They're clearing a nearby field where they hope family members will soon build houses. The women chip in every week to perform communal work like this. Other tasks include digging drainage ditches and repairing roads. They even take in turns going on nightly patrols to ward off delinquents. Obdulia Dominguez says the solidarity of the women makes up for the hardships of her life as a single mother.
In a group, it gives you strength to go on. Alone, you feel overwhelmed. We come here every week chatting in a big group, and we don't even feel the time go by.
But those brave faces also mask pain. Many of the women have husbands in the U.S., and the separation is taking its toll on the families. Obdulia hasn't seen her husband in 7 years. He used to send money regularly, she says, but now she hardly hears from him. Maria Santos considers herself luckier.
Well, I'm not a single mother because my husband sends me money, and he's always in touch. He's very responsible.
Then the pride disappears from her voice.
You can't imagine. It's really hard. I've told him so many times, come home, even if we just have to eat beans. Your children need you. But he says, I don't want them to be laborers living day to day. I want them to say it was worth it my dad was there, so that we can grow up to be someone. And then there's nothing left to say. I just say, good luck. Don't give up.
The next day, the women gather in a field for a weekly meeting. As their children play in the background, an assistant to their political benefactor explains they may soon be able to buy their lots for a few hundred dollars each. Maria says that will be a big relief.
What do I need for my life to be better? For them to say, here's your title to your land. That would be so much easier. And if my husband were here with me.
But for now, she has her children and the house she built herself. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Jalapa, Mexico.
Just ahead, a Zimbabwean journalist who's been living abroad tells us what it's like to go back home. You're listening to the World Vision Report. Stay with us.
Hoy vuelvo a la frontera. Otra vez he de atravesar. Es el viento que me manda, que me empuja a la frontera.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On September 15th, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai signed a power-sharing agreement. The agreement could help end political strife in the country and bring about economic recovery. After a bitter and violent election in March this year, people from both sides came together at the signing ceremony to celebrate. The road ahead won't be short or easy. Inflation is at 11,000,000%. For most people, just getting by is a challenge. Reporter Tendai Maposa recently returned to the capital, Harare, after a 2-year absence. He has this reporter's notebook.
While I was gone, family and friends told me about the country's worsening economic crisis. But nothing prepared me for the reality I found once I landed at Harare International Airport. My daughter was there to meet me. She didn't have enough Zimbabwean dollars to pay for the taxi. This wasn't because she was broke. It was because at the time, people could only withdraw a maximum of 500 Zimbabwean dollars from the bank each day. That's about $1. That was just enough to buy a loaf of bread. So we paid for the taxi in US dollars. Officially, it's illegal to do business in US dollars, but now everyone is taking them. Less than half an hour after we got home, the power went out and stayed out for 12 hours. These days, power cuts are guaranteed. So are water cuts in some areas. In fact, many people I know are digging wells in their backyards, right in the middle of the city. That afternoon, I went with a friend to the supermarket. The shelves were almost empty. I just could not believe the prices. A bottle of olive oil cost the equivalent of 50 US dollars. So my friend suggested we cross the border into Mozambique to get some basics. The following day, we drove 5 hours to the nearest town on the other side of the border. I had asked other people if they wanted me to bring stuff back for them, and so I had a long shopping list. Sugar, cooking oil, flour, dishwashing liquid, and cornmeal, which is the basic food stuff here. My daughter's needs were more luxurious. Dad, I haven't had any chocolate for a very long time. She got her wish, but I could only bring back a few of the things the others had asked for. The shelves of the supermarket in Mozambique had a lot of empty spaces. Other Zimbabweans had already been there. Meanwhile, here at home, the prices just keep going up. Recently, I passed by my local Chinese takeout, where I used to have a weekly order of tofu, a favorite of mine. When I dropped by, the owners were really happy to see me. That day, the price of a cake of tofu was 160 Zimbabwe dollars. By the following week, the price had almost doubled. But while I worry about tofu and olive oil, other people are worrying about more basic needs, such as getting enough cornmeal and plain cooking oil to feed their families. You might wonder why people put up with this, but many of them are so scared of losing the little they have that they will not protest. Still, for me, there are things about coming back home that are priceless, like seeing my daughter and parents. Friends have really gone out of their way to help me adjust, and I, like my compatriots, feel energized when I watch those stunning African sunsets, a luxury I missed living in London. Also, you hear the old saying about nothing lasting forever a lot here. It's early days yet, but maybe the signing of that power-sharing agreement could be the beginning of the end of our suffering.
Tendai Maphosa is a freelance journalist based in Harare. Farther north, the government of Liberia has been encouraging tens of thousands of its citizens to come home. Many of them are scattered in refugee camps across West Africa. Liberia's civil war ended 4 years ago, but the refugees are in no hurry to return. Daryl Harvey explains why.
Josh Safis has been living here at the Budaburu refugee camp outside Ghana's capital, Accra, for 15 years. In that time, he married and now has two children. He's got a job as a journalist and photographer, and on the side, he publishes the camp's only monthly newspaper. In many ways, Safis has built a life here. But he says he's tired. Tired of being paid under the table, since he has no legal status here. Tired of living in a camp. Just tired of being a refugee.
I can't continue to be here. I will always be a Liberian. And while here, I will always be seen as a refugee, as a foreigner.
Safis will be returning to Liberia in a few months. He says it was a gut-wrenching decision. It's one that thousands of Liberians in refugee camps across West Africa have been facing since their country's civil war ended more than 4 years ago. The war shattered families. But today, deciding whether to return is also proving divisive, even in the newsroom of Safis' camp newspaper. This edition coming off the presses today could be one of the paper's last. That's because Safis plans to take the paper with him back to Liberia. Some of the newspaper's volunteer staff have decided to return with him, but many more have not. Editor Joseph Swen is one of them. Swen is doing the opposite. He's digging in, building a latrine behind the three-room concrete house he's lived in since he fled Liberia 14 years ago. Despite assurances by the UN that the country is safe, Swen has his doubts. During the war, Swen was recruited to fight for a rebel faction. He refused and was tortured. He ultimately escaped, but in retaliation, his family's home was burned down and his father was killed. Swen fears retribution if he returns.
I still have the fear. I don't want to see myself back in a situation where friends who made life so miserable for me will see me and thinking that would be so suspicious, thinking that I myself am going to pay them back. And they have that fear and decide to just eliminate me once and for all so that they don't have to be looking over their shoulders.
Swen says he turned down a repatriation package offered by the UN that would have helped him return home. Instead, he's enrolled in a university in Ghana. And like many of his neighbors on the camp, he's pinning his hopes on official resettlement in another country. He'd like to end up in Europe, America, or Australia. But Swen is probably waiting in vain. Now that the war's over, the number of refugees being settled in third countries has slowed to a trickle. The message is, if refugees want assistance, they had better go home. That's why Jos Safis is returning to Liberia. He thinks his friends and colleagues on the camp should do the same.
How long would it take for you to continue, you know, to be living on a mirage? I'm above that level. I believe my America, my Europe, my Canada, my success is my mind.
But what awaits refugees who return home? Unemployment in Liberia is running at 80%. With those prospects, it's easy to see why dreams of a one-way ticket to the West are proving difficult to shake. But for many refugees, waiting around for that chance is getting harder and harder. The UN, which oversees the refugee camps, has been cutting back on services and soon plans to pull out altogether. Refugees may have no choice but to give up on their dreams of resettlement in Europe or America and return to the reality of Liberia. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daryl Harvey at the Budaburum Refugee Camp, Ghana.
The Indian government is aggressively tackling poverty in that country. It has a plan in place that guarantees some paid work every year to each person who lives below the poverty line. That's about a third of a billion people. Most of the work is manual labor, and it pays around $2 a day. For many, that's more than they usually have in their pockets. Mia and Ridge covered this story for the Christian Science Monitor, and she spoke with us from India.
The basic idea behind this program is to tackle one of the biggest problems that modern India is facing, which is the exodus of poor people from the countryside into the cities, which don't have the infrastructure to deal with their present populations, let alone new populations. So the idea is to give work to keep people in the places that they live. And Indians who are poor are entitled under this new scheme to 100 days of work at the minimum wage, wherever and whoever they are.
Are they having to just create jobs that aren't necessary, or are these real jobs that need to be filled?
Well, this is one of the slightly dubious bits of the scheme that's earned lots of criticism, because 60% of the funds for this project must go, under the terms of the Act that governs the scheme, to unskilled labour. So that's a lot of money going to people who don't actually know how to do the things that India really needs, build schools, hospitals, roads. So at the moment, people are doing sort of ditch digging, building ponds, doing irrigation schemes.
So what the government is doing, in order to keep people without jobs in the countryside from streaming into the cities, they're offering them a minimum of 100 days work. Can they make enough money to survive off 100 days of work?
Well, the people I met in southern Rajasthan, I visited a couple of projects, a couple of sites there, and the people I spoke to there said that it was because the salaries that they were getting were much, much higher than in the past. So, for example, there was a woman who used to commute every summer when the rains dried up and the farming basically stops in Rajasthan, which is a desert state. She used to go to Haryana to make plaster of Paris Hindu statues, and she used to get 50 rupees there a day, and now she gets 100. So it's like the equivalent of earning twice as much, really.
And this money is enough to keep them, to keep their families surviving and not having to come to the cities to beg.
Well, the minimum wage under the terms of the scheme, because the minimum wage varies a lot from state to state, is 60 rupees, and that's a lot more than the women I talked to in Rajasthan had been earning before. But one of the other really important things about this scheme is what happens when poor people migrate, is that they take their children with them, either to cities or to other states, to small towns, to earn money. So their children don't get an opportunity for a proper education, and that's one of the reasons why the government's really backing the scheme and putting lots of money into it.
Mia, and you visited one of the work sites. Can you tell us a little bit about it? What did you see? How many people were working and what kind of work were they doing?
Yeah, there were about 43 people, mostly women, as is the case in Rajasthan. It's the women who tend to do the manual labor, dressed in very beautiful, bright colored clothes, as people there do. They were building a flood defense wall outside a village. So there was a few of them breaking up this very, very hard, dry earth with a pickaxe, and others shoveling the earth into panniers, which they carry on their heads, carry over to the wall, and then build the wall. It was very simple, but back-breaking work. And there are some other big innovations at this particular work site. Generally speaking, in Rajasthan, even though it's most the women who do the manual labor, the sort of boss, the foreman of the site, is always a man. But Jalore, this district in Rajasthan, has introduced a law whereby a third of the foremen have to be women.
And did you speak to any of the women about how this program was affecting their lives so far? Maybe it was too early to tell, but what were their thoughts about it?
Well, this project has been running since last May, so it was possible to see that it really was making a difference to their lives. There was one 30-year-old woman with four children who used to go to Jodhpur every summer for 3 or 4 months to work on a construction site. There she would earn 60 rupees a day, and her children would sit at the side of the road with her while she built roads and buildings. In her present job, she earns 100 rupees a day, which is already a big improvement. All her children are at school for the first time, and she's not having to worry about what she will do when the really bad weather comes. She's feeling settled, she says, for the first time in years.
I'm wondering about corruption. There's such a massive amount of money going into this program. How is the government protecting against corruption to make sure the money really gets into the hands of the people who need it?
Well, even the biggest critics of this scheme say that this system, this project, has more protections against corruption than any of the schemes of the past. And there was a report by an independent agency about the scheme. Despite all its criticisms, it didn't come up with any serious evidence of corruption.
What is the consensus about how well this program is working or not working?
People in India are very, very ready to be critical of this kind of program. And at the moment, I would say that was the prevailing feeling. You know, until there's evidence to the contrary, people assume that the money will not reach the very poor, that there'll be a lot of corruption and ineffectual sort of talking and not enough action. But there's enough evidence in places like Rajasthan that this project can work if the administration is really behind it and great efforts are made. So I don't think it should be discounted yet.
Mian Ridge in New Delhi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mian Ridge is a freelance reporter based in New Delhi. And still in India, the rising price of oil is causing hardship for many. But it's having one positive and unintended effect. Here's our globe at a glance. Camels are making a comeback in India. The ship of the desert has been passed over in recent years for shiny new tractors. But now, as the cost of gas soars, farmers are taking another look at the traditional desert animal. A sturdy male can live 60 to 80 years. That's a little longer than the life of even the best tractor. It doesn't need gas to get it going. And a camel costs about $1,000. An entry-level tractor costs 4 times that amount. This makes animal lovers happy. So far, the surge in oil prices means that fewer camels are being slaughtered for their meat. That's our globe at a glance. You're listening to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The village of Bario is on the island of Borneo, deep in the Malaysian jungle. It's accessible only by air or by foot. That means there is little imported food available for visitors on the island. As a result, tourist lodges go wild. Nancy Greenlee sends us the latest installment in our series, What's Cooking?
In an open-air kitchen at the Bario Backpacker Lodge, lunch preparations are in full swing. Locals and tourists will dine today on freshly hunted deer and a vegetable side dish made of greens and wild ginger flowers collected a couple of days ago. 28-year-old Jacqueline Dominique is in charge, watching an assistant to make sure she chops only the leaves on the greens. Dominique gives the Kalabat name for the side dish's ingredients.
The green name is pa upa.
And the wild ginger flower is called?
Bois ludu.
Where do you get them?
We find it from in the jungle. And the paupau, we found it near the river. Yeah, we have to wash them a lot because we have to wash the sand to clear it from the dust. That's why we have to wash it clearly.
A big circular pan, like a wok, sits on the stove. Dominique fires up the gas. She pours in palm oil. Next, she tosses in red onion.
When the smell is up, and then we put the paupa inside.
What does it smell like?
It's like one perfume. Yeah, it smells like a perfume. Yeah, I like it very much. Now we put the ginger leaf inside. Color is red, green. It looks lovely to see. Now we have put some salt.
Oh, and this is famous salt, right?
Yeah, clubbing salt is not very sour.
The salt here bubbles up in a nearby spring where people collect and process it. After 4 minutes, our greens are luminescent and ready to eat.
Small plate for you, okay?
Okay. Mm. For me, it tastes nutty. It's not wet. It's not soggy. This is light.
Yeah, very, yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Mm. Thank you very much. My compliments to the chef.
Okay.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Nancy Greenlace in the village of Bario, Malaysia.
Up, sister power, and it's not what you think. Stay with us. Samba malato, lando. Samba malato, lando. Samba malato. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Learning to read well is critical for success, but millions of American families can't afford to buy books for their children. Even when publishers want to donate the books, they often don't get into the hands of the kids that truly need them. Alex Goldmark reports on one innovative solution that's changing that.
Girls, if you're done with your homework, you need to go into the art space for martial arts.
About a dozen young girls are finishing up their homework inside a clean and unassuming storefront in East Harlem. This is Sister Power, an after-school and mentoring center for local girls. Founder Cynthia Kirkpatrick shows me around.
So this area here is really the tutoring homework help area. The girls come here, they sit down with their tutors, and they get assistance with their homework.
She saves the most popular room for last.
This is the favorite hangout, believe it or not. This is the library. And when a girl walks in who is, let's say, in the first, second grade, you have books all around the bottom that meet her at eye level, from Disney's Beauty and the Beast to Curious George to Dr. Seuss to Amiya Bedia.
And on, the older girls get to choose from the classics and some contemporary favorites like Harry Potter or Chicken Soup for the pre-teenage soul. The best part is, they get to keep the books if they want to. And because all the girls here come from low-income families, this room is usually their primary source for new books. I asked them about the books they had at home before and after they joined Sister Power.
Books were old and raggedy because they came from either my mom, my grandmother, or my school.
How many did you have?
Like 10.
And now how many do you have?
50.
I got more than that. I got like 100.
100 books.
Because I have...
I'd be taller than you.
No. When I get a brand new book, I really like it because then I take more care of it.
So how does Sister Power come by these brand new books? Thanks to another group called First Book. Founder Kyle Zimmer says her organization has a simple mission.
we provide brand new books to children from low-income families. We've been focused on this mission for 15 years, and I'm happy to tell you that we have placed almost 50 million books into the hands of children in the United States.
Here's how it works. Publishers big and small donate overstocked books on the condition that they only go to needy children. Then, using special software and donated warehouse space, First Book matches specific books with specific kids in their network of community groups. That way, the books go to children who've asked for them and might actually read them. That's something that can be hard for publishers to pull off.
Prior to establishing the First Book National Book Bank, what happened was people in local tutoring and mentoring programs, maybe in a church basement, would call Simon & Schuster or Random House or Scholastic, and they would say, can you send us 13 books for the boys we're working with? And the publishers want to do the right thing, and they would do everything they could. But when the volume of those calls becomes so staggering, that's quite a weight for an industry to bear.
There are lots of reasons for this. For one, it costs money just to store unsold books. Alexandra Nash knows this well. She's with Candlewick Press. After her company redesigned the cover of their popular Judy Moody series, they didn't want to sell the old ones anymore. But giving thousands of books away was too expensive because of shipping and logistical costs. So, believe it or not, it can be cheaper to destroy a book than to donate it.
The process is sometimes called pulping a book. And it's just absolutely makes your heart cry when you think about that process actually going into effect. And I think with organizations like First Book, that happens probably less and less now.
So Judy Moody didn't get pulped. And that means a lot to groups like Sister Power, says founder Cynthia Kirkpatrick.
What happens is that we get all these books and they come fresh, brand new in a box. I let the kids open the books, open the boxes themselves. It feels like Christmas every day when the books come.
Before I came here, I really didn't read at all. I would read little books and try to get away with it. But when I came to Sister Power, I saw a lot of big books. And my mind started hitting, oh my goodness, look at all these books. And when I started reading them, I started enjoying them.
And now I'm reading higher books and I am a better reader. I read faster than I used to.
So you're all getting good grades, right?
Yes.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Alex Goldmark in East Harlem, New York.
From Sister Power, we go to a school called Hope Flowers. It's in a small hilltop village just outside the West Bank city of Bethlehem. In spite of being in the middle of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the school is teaching children to embrace reconciliation, not retribution. Dale Gavlak sent us this report.
A mere 6 miles of road separates Bethlehem from Jerusalem. But the once unbroken skyline between the two cities no longer exists. A towering 20-foot gray cement wall now seals off Bethlehem. It's part of Israel's West Bank separation barrier to keep out would-be suicide bombers. Colored graffiti litter the wall. One message reads, "Fear builds walls, hope builds peace." Palestinians can pass through a large metal turnstile like this one only after Israeli soldiers check identity cards and permission papers. For the townspeople of Bethlehem, the encircling wall is like a prison. The economy here has been badly hit by the barrier. Fewer tourists are coming to Bethlehem, and fewer Palestinians are able to work in Israel. And wall construction has taken over Palestinian farmland. Many families are struggling to survive. It's amid these tensions that the Hope Flowers School forges ahead. Palestinian children play tag at the far end of the schoolyard before the start of classes. The Hope Flowers School is located in the tiny neighboring village of Al-Khadr. It educates 300 children until 7th grade and puts peace and democracy at the heart of its teaching. Qada Issa Gabun is the school's principal.
The idea of this school is to find a new Palestinian generation who believes in democracy and peace and to find a new way of education, which is not typical, and to teach the children in the sense of peace rather than in the sense of war.
Inside a brightly lit classroom, enthusiastic fourth graders jockey with each other to give the answer to math problems. Multiplication tables and colorful pictures decorate the walls. In addition to a normal curriculum, teachers here show children how to handle confrontation and to work with each other to resolve disputes. Through drama and role-playing, the children begin to see things through different viewpoints. Gabon's father, Ibrahim Issa, founded the school 28 years ago. He grew up in the grinding poverty and harsh conditions of a refugee camp. Rather than harboring revenge, his daughter says he sought to bring together children from both sides of the conflict.
This is why the Hope Flowers is here. This is why it is founded, you know, and it did lots of work in bringing people from various backgrounds, from various cultures, from various nations together. So the Hope Flowers is founded, you know, to build trust, to build the bridges, to bring people together, to promote dialogue, to promote coexistence.
Hope Flowers has been a pioneer in a number of ways. It was the first school in the Palestinian territories to have interfaith lessons, in which Christian and Muslim pupils stay together to learn about each other's faiths. It has also invited rabbis from Israel to teach students about Judaism, and it has held exchange programs with Israeli schools. But those have virtually come to a halt. That's because the Israeli government now forbids its citizens to enter the areas in the West Bank that are totally under the control of the Palestinian Authority. 11-year-old students Suhai Mohammed Raad and Dina Ibrahim Surana both have a gentle and peace-loving attitude, like the other Hope Flower students I met. Despite the fact that Dina's parents are out of work, mainly due to the barrier, she seems to hold no bitterness. I accept the Israelis, she says. I believe we are going to be happy in the future. If they want to live with us, that would make me very pleased. Sahai chimes in. He says he believes reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis is possible. We shouldn't be killing each other, he says. We can live in peace. I ask Suhai what he thinks of the wall.
No.
There needs to be freedom, he adds. But the wall is closing in on these Palestinian children in more ways than one. The barrier and the suicide bombings that led to its construction have robbed many parents of jobs. That's made it difficult for families to pay the small tuition the school charges. Again, Principal Ghada Issa Gabun.
Our students come from poor families in the villages and in the refugee camps, and they depend on their income and working inside Israel. We have a large number of students who can't pay anything because their parents are totally unemployed. The school wanted to protect these children from leaving the school and start working in early age, so we offer them full scholarships just to guarantee their enrollment at the school for their well-being.
The U.S., Canada, Germany, and other nations help defray some of the school's operating costs. Gabun says it's hard raising the needed funds, but feels Hope Flowers' mission leaves no other option.
Only two choices. Either you keep the hope among these children and their parents, or, you know, you just make them more desperate, which will be very dangerous at the end. So it's only two choices, you know, either to laugh or to cry, you know. We take this choice of, you know, keeping the hope and building on that.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Dale Gavlak in Bethlehem.
Cries for social and political justice are often expressed through music. Think of protest songs from the 60s or the massive rock concerts like Live Aid that raised money to fight poverty. In that same spirit, a couple of American college students have launched a music label devoted to African social justice.
The bombs are made in London, but the bombing is in Congo. The bombing now for Togo. Tanks are built in Russia.
Eric Herman is one of the founders of the Modiba label. He first discovered African music while on a college trip to Mali. That's also when he saw firsthand all of the challenges facing Africa. When Eric returned to the U.S., he and a friend put the two together and came up with Modiba. Eric Herman joined us on the show to talk about the Modiba label.
There's an audience in the United States for African music, albeit a very small and kind of fringe one. And there's an audience in the United States for African political and social issues. There's people that care about AIDS and care about the genocide in Darfur and that care about a whole slew of issues that are afflicting Africa. And oftentimes, it's even the same people that are curious and interested in the music and interested in the political issues. Yet there was no bridge to really meld the two into something that could be galvanizing, that could advance the causes while also advancing the music. That was our initial conception, was to be able to use music as a vehicle for driving African empowerment and social and political advancement.
And so the first album you and your business partner put out on your label is called ASAP, which stands for the Afrobeat Sudan Aid Project. Let's start by listening to the first song on that album, because it's very interesting.
The United Nations has called it one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. More than 1 million people in the Darfur region of Western Sudan have been forced from their homes.
A lot of them have lost everything that they have.
The destruction is total. There's nothing left for the people who flee these attacks to return to.
The humanitarian crisis in this war-torn country is far from over.
Well, that's a pretty literal example of what you're talking about. I mean, are those the voices of newscasters over African music?
Yeah, newscasters and experts. Some we did private interviews with, others we pulled from the internet and then sought permission from their organizations. And yeah, so that was the track that we, Modiba, my production company, kind of remixed in effect by splicing those news bites and interview bites on top of it to really try to tell the story of Darfur.
What's been the response to that song?
That song was really quite popular and became one of the theme songs, I think, for the Darfur movement, at least early on. Don Cheadle liked it a lot and picked it up for use on an MTV program. And it was a top seller on iTunes Music Store for quite a few weeks.
Now, was this whole ASAP album designed to raise money for Darfur?
Yeah, absolutely. The concept was to amass all of this Afrobeat talent that we were coming into contact with from around the world. And, I mean, because I should preface this by saying that Afrobeat is an inherently political music. It was created as a driving force for social change in Nigeria. And so we wanted to team up with all of these Afrobeat groups that we were coming into contact with and put out a 100% benefit album when we had the original goal of raising $100,000 for the refugees. And we actually exceeded that goal within a week of release. And then we ended up spending the next year, as we were seniors in college, reaching out to the rest of the college community in the country, getting it out to over 30 schools and having satellite sellers on all of those campuses. And we've pushed it up to about $140,000, and we're still selling it today.
$140,000. And where is that money actually going?
At first, it was going to a group called Kebkaiya, and they were mysteriously actually shut down. But then we quickly linked up with Save the Children, which had a little bit more of a firm foundation elsewhere in the world. And so was being supported a little bit more solidly. So we've since been giving all of our proceeds to Save the Children in Sudan to provide the refugees with clean water and food and medical supplies and that sort of thing.
Okay, Eric, you mentioned that you drew in a lot of very popular Afrobeat musicians for this first album. And for those in our listening audience who don't exactly listen to Afrobeat regularly or know what it sounds like, I'd love to play a little bit of that. Can you suggest a song on this ASAP album that would best exemplify Afrobeat music?
Yeah, sure. Why don't we play the fifth track on the album, which is called Progress, which is by Tony Allen, who's one of the founders of Afrobeat, and featuring Fela Kuti, who's the other founder of Afrobeat. So this is stuff, this was music that emerged in the very late 60s, early 70s, and heavily influenced by James Brown and Western funk and soul, but mixing Yoruba and Nigerian rhythms with it and putting a very serious political bend. And so, yeah, this track is a great example of Afrobeat in its original form.
Eric Herman joined us from his office in New York. You can find out more and listen to more music on our website, worldvisionreport.org. That brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can hear us online or download a podcast of this show and listen to us anytime. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. Our production team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.